Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Damage Board. I'm Johnny Rolla. It is Wednesday. It is JR Rated.
Man, JR Wednesdays. Hey, you know, I was a little surprised for you. I've been wanting to have something I tell you every Wednesday. I've only been able to do it once. But you know what? Just because John is Mr. Electronic, no manly gas-powered cars because he's not a real American, I'm going to hit you with this quick story.
Okay.
A new study warns, excuse me, wow, puberty's hitting. A new study warns that self-driving cars, quote, could more than double vehicle traffic in cities because they cruise around at slow speeds. They don't have to park because there's not humans inside. So therefore, we're creating more traffic with your new technology on your. What do they need to park for?
They cruise Why do they around need parking at slow speeds? Fees? They go at normal speeds.
Not when they're not driving someone around. You know what? I think we need to get back to our old, good old American gas-powered vehicle, Chevy, Ford, Chrysler. Give me a 350
Plymouth.
Hemi. Go ahead and put that 454 in there. What happened to my carburetors? That's what we need to go back to.
Okay, somebody has taken all the wrong lessons from last night's State of the Union and is now pining for some fictional version of America.
All I remember is last night,
no traffic.
Last night I heard that we're the biggest export of natural gas and oil again in America. Mm-hmm. F yeah.
Yeah, let's contribute to climate change. Woo! Anyway.
Hey, maybe sit in traffic, John Adarola.
Okay, I think we will have this debate for the entirety of the rest of the hour. And then maybe we'll get to something else. No, there's lots to get to. We're going to be talking about the State of the Union. Could you have guessed it? We're going to be doing an evaluation of some of the different excerpts from the State of the Union, evaluate whether they were true or not. A little bit later on. Oh, and in particular, I want to dive into an awesome chart that was constructed that will help to evaluate Donald Trump's claims about job growth. That'll be a little bit later on. Very exciting stuff, as all charts tend to be. But along the way, we also have a couple of guests. So we're going to be joined by Matthew Liebman, who's going to talk about an update on one of the ag gag laws that have been operating in the US. These laws that stop undercover investigations of what's going on inside of factory farms. As a person who has edited the products of some of these investigations, the videos that have been shot, they are illuminating about what's going on in these places. And so we do have a little bit of positive progress on that. We're also going to be joined by Roger Wolfson, a Democratic consultant and writer, a little bit later on the show, to give his evaluation of both the State of the Union and the responses from the point of view of someone who works to construct speeches that actually persuade people and things. So we're going to get some of that expert opinion a little bit later on as well. And with that, why don't we jump into it? Because I know there's a lot of videos that you were able to pull yesterday that we do want to get to. So we're going to try to get to as much as possible. In last night's State of the Union, Donald Trump stretched the truth just a wee bit in a couple of cases. Maybe this is nitpicking, but why don't we go through and identify a few of the places where he was not quite accurate necessarily. So first off, on the economy, he said something that you just say. You say because America's number one, you know, oorah and all that. But he said, after 24 months of rapid progress, our economy is the envy of the world. Our military is the most powerful on earth, and America's winning each and every day.
What does that mean?
America is winning Super Bowls too with very low scores. So look, saying finally, after 24 months of progress, our military is the strongest on earth is a ridiculous statement. We spend so much and have for literally decades. Our military has for a very long time been by far the strongest because we spend way more than the next, you know, umpteenth people
I'm
after
sure
us.
I'm not sure why we can keep saying that we haven't done anything as far as military in our history and then now it's suddenly started. That would go on to say that America's been weak this whole time. Why have we been singing the national anthem for so long saying we're the best, we're number one for all these years? Has that not been the case? No, it's the same thing. You can just make up what the past was as you continue to do the same thing, inflating military spending and say that it's somehow this big change and now we've finally come around to starting wars in every country we can find.
Yeah, and so I just bring that up as a person who hates. Look, it's bad enough if we're going to waste all this money on the military, but if we're going to do it by lying about how they're playing, everything's falling apart, we don't have any boats anymore. That bothers me as an individual. But let's go to the economy part. So he says, after 24 months, our economy is the envy of the world. Well, portions of the world probably would like to have our economic growth, but not everybody. Okay, there's a few places that are actually doing better, it turns out. Here are some examples. They're the ones you'd think of. Growth in Latvia and Poland were almost twice as fast over the past 2 years. Same for China and India. Even the troubled Greek economy posted stronger growth. And Greece is like the country that for a decade now has been used as like if you want to talk about economic instability, that's the one you go to. Well, they had stronger growth, okay? That doesn't mean that they're necessarily better in all ways than we are. It doesn't mean their economy is terrible in every way. But especially when we're relying only on these macroeconomic numbers that really leave, like they cast to the side the experience of actual working Americans, what they're actually going through by focusing things like unemployment, stock market growth, things like that. But even when you're gonna use those, you do have to be honest about how other countries are doing. And he is not going to do that.
Of course not. It doesn't. We know where this goes. Let's continue.
We do. So why don't we turn to immigration, where we knew this was going to be a big portion of the speech. He's been talking about this nonstop for, you know, since he descended down that golden elevator. So you'd think he'd at least have his facts straight by now, but he is not. He wants a wall, and he's willing to lie to get it. He said the border city of El Paso, Texas, used to have extremely high rates of violent crime, one of the highest in the entire country, and considered one of the nation's most dangerous cities. Now, immediately upon its building, talk about a wall that was built there, with a powerful barrier in place, El Paso is one of the safest cities in our country. That is almost entirely inaccurate historically. And many of the people who work in law enforcement there, historians and all that, have gone back and looked at the numbers. They've talked about the experience of working there, living there. El Paso was not some den of iniquity before the wall was built. It was a pretty safe place. And they did not immediately have some big drop in violent crime after the wall was built. In fact, in the immediate years after the wall was built, the murder rate, which was low, ticked up slightly. Because so none of that is accurate. He just needs some example of walls working.
It's as if the facts that he's throwing around don't have anything to do with the wall thing. So whenever your violent crime or whatever it is that ticked up a bit, it would show that it has nothing to do with what was happening with the wall. It's something that some other factors maybe happened. You know, we always say certain parts of the year there's more crime than others. Maybe just whatever. Maybe there's, who knows what those factors are. I'm sure some studies could find that out. So as long as you just say something and then you know that the rest of your audience is not going to actually try and figure out what the truth is behind it, you just say it and move along. It was also bothering me the way that he was, the way that he portrayed Latinos in this entire thing and black folks. He had his instances of when they talked about Alice Johnson, you know, and then the crime, the change in
the criminal justice bill,
right? Mm-hmm. So that's the only time he speaks about black folks. And the unemployment rate is down. So black folks are coming out with the two instances are they were saved by me because they were in jail for too long because they're criminals. And then Latinos, they cross the border and they bring all this crime, MS-13, and then, oh, you know, that those border cities that are so scary.
Yeah.
The folks that listen to him would be afraid to go to El Paso, Texas after hearing what he's saying. Mm-hmm. They'd be like, oh, I heard he said something about El Paso and Latinos.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a painting the picture of certain folks, and that's what his unity message was last night.
And that's been true for a couple of years. Literally, the only time he'll talk about these communities is in connection to these things. He doesn't think that they live full human lives outside of these topics. So he had the lie with El Paso, an example of a wall that he thought would buttress his point, but it instead undercuts it. He has one other, that is San Diego. He's previously talked about it. He says, San Diego used to have the most illegal border crossings in our country. In response, a strong security wall was put in place. This powerful barrier almost completely ended illegal crossings. So if you look at the numbers, over the past two decades or so, illegal crossings in San Diego have gone down significantly. One reason for that is that border crossings have gone down significantly everywhere. Whether there's a wall or there's no wall, far, far fewer people are actually crossing the border in either direction. It's one of the reasons that we state that we do not have a national emergency at the border. Now, during that time, when you had a lot of border crossings and now you have a lot less, a lot of things have changed. I could simply say that they're responsible for border crossings going down. Kevin Spacey was taken off the House of Cards. Maybe that contributed to it. I don't know. Pop-Tarts has way more flavors than it used to. Prove to me that that's not why border crossings are down. But look, I'm not an expert on San Diego or the wall or whatever, so I will lead it to people who are experts. According to the Congressional Research Service, the fence in San Diego alone, quote, did not have a discernible impact on the number of immigrants crossing the border into the U.S. illegally.
So you started that quote by according to the Congressional Research Service. If we go back to the previous quote that Trump had when he's talking about what happened in San Diego and then the numbers have gone down, did you notice anything where he said according to and based on and because of the study of?
I did not.
He just said illegal. This used to be the biggest free-flowing illegal immigrant crossing in the country. Then later it changed. It changed because of the wall. Based on what? Who said so besides you? Mm-hmm. No one ever asked that question and just comes with it and just blatant. Because you know what? It's obvious because there's no one he can trust, because the people that he does trust that have facts, as we saw him conflict with his intelligence agencies over and over again, he doesn't trust them if the facts don't fit his narrative.
Yeah. No, he's never going to cite anything. Now, perhaps even worse, last point, he says, I want people to come into our country in the largest numbers ever, but they have to come in legally. And I think that that is one of the most insidious lies. Because, look, we know since day one, he was calling immigrants crossing the border, or migrants crossing the border, rapists and murderers and all of that. But to also lie about this, to say, it's just I don't want them coming illegally. They can come legally. We want that. We love that. That's in the greatest American tradition. When they're trying to cut by huge quantities the number of people who are allowed to come here legally. It's in their bills. They know Absolutely. That it's going to be fact checked. They don't care. They need this for narrative purposes. And that is also that's unfortunate to see that willful lying coming from the President of the United States. Now, we are going to have more fact checks on North Korea, investigations of corruption in the White House and other topics a little bit later on the show. So stick around. After this, we're going to be joined to break down the latest on ag-gag laws across the country. Stick around.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
And now for a little bit of good news, the director of litigation for the Animal Defense Fund, Matthew Liebman, joins us on the Damage Report. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
Glad to have you here. So there has been a development in Iowa on one of these ag-gag laws that helps to hide some of the cruelty and you know, just terrible treatment of animals in factory farms. Could you give us the rundown on what exactly happened?
Sure. Yeah. So this is these are laws that make it a crime to conduct an undercover investigation at a factory farm or a slaughterhouse. And we just had a big victory last month when the district court in Iowa declared the Iowa statute unconstitutional as a violation of the First Amendment. And this was a statute that essentially made it a crime to gain access to one of these facilities to show what truly happens to animals on factory farms.
So there have previously been cases, it's one of the reasons we got these laws, where people went undercover, they filmed what was going on, and they've revealed some truly horrible things. In those sorts of investigations, what sort of practices have we found out about?
Yeah, and there have been dozens of these investigations over the last few years, and every single one has shown really egregious treatment of animals. And the industry wants to say that they really just show a few bad apples, a few line workers who are acting out. But in fact, the most significant thing that these investigations reveal are practices that are common and pervasive and really endemic to factory farming and the corporate model of turning animals from sentient beings into objects. And they show things like intensive confinement of chickens in battery cages for eggs, pregnant pigs in gestation crates for pork. They show routine mutilations of farmed animals, things like removing the beaks of egg-laying hens, removing the tails of animals without anesthesia, really horrific things that factory farming relies on as a business model.
You know, it seems like if their argument is that these investigations show just a few bad apples, I think they're moving in the wrong direction. They shouldn't be trying to ban cameras. They should be putting live streaming webcams in all of their factory farms. If it's all, you know, run of the mill, it's all going well, these are just bad apples, then they should want people to see what's going on there. Obviously, that is not the case. And as I said in the last segment, I've actually previously for videos we've done for the Young Turks, I used to edit the videos of what's happening in these pork farms and things like that. And seeing people just throw piglets and step on them and things like that is absolutely disgusting. Now, I am curious, whenever you pass a bill like this, I mean, we understand why the factory farms would want these sorts of bills, but what is the argument that they provide to attempt to justify them?
Well, they've gotten a little bit more sophisticated. Some of the early bills were pretty transparent about what they wanted. They said these animal rights groups are going in and revealing how animals are treated on factory farms, and it's hurting our bottom line and making us look bad, and we need to kill the messenger, was essentially their original argument. But of course, as the backlash to these bills has grown, they've tried to get more sophisticated. In Iowa, for example, they claim that this was about biosecurity, about keeping out unauthorized workers who, undercover activists or journalists who might spread diseases, which is, of course, ridiculous. You know, if you've ever been to one of these facilities, they are absolutely filthy. We're talking, you know, thousands of animals in horrific conditions. And the idea that it's the journalists or the animal rights activists who are doing undercover investigations that are posing a biosecurity threat rather than the abuse of animals, I think really gives the lie to the rationales that they're coming forward with.
So I know that in the recent history, there's been a couple of different states that have cracked down on this. There have been a couple of good developments like in Iowa earlier this year. Has there been any polling? Do we know what people actually think about these sorts of laws? Do they actually support them?
Most people don't. Certainly, if you look nationwide, there's a huge backlash to these laws. And of course, people are saying if the meat industry is having to pass laws that make it illegal to do undercover investigations, what are they trying to hide? But even in states where these have passed, states like Idaho and Utah, there's overwhelming opposition from people to these laws. And I think it really demonstrates the outsized influence that the agricultural lobby has at state houses across the country, especially in states that are heavily reliant on agriculture for their economy.
So has there been any movement to attempt to do something at the federal level in terms of these laws?
There hasn't been. I don't think either on the ag industry side or the animal protection side. I mean, it would be great if we could have sort of a federal law that preempted the ability of states to pass these kinds of laws. But I think getting that accomplished in Washington, D.C. is a pretty tall task. Certainly, there have been efforts at the federal level to undercut animal protection laws at the state level. But so far, there hasn't been an effort at a nationwide ag gag law.
And just to step back just briefly with one last question. So we're talking about videos that have come out in the past few years, laws that have been instituted in recent history. But this sort of battle over allowing the public to know what's going on in the production and manufacture of their food, I mean, this is like a longstanding part of American, of journalism, of our culture, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it goes back to Upton Sinclair and the jungle, you know, the very foundations of investigative journalism at the turn of the last century. You know, this has been an issue that has concerned people. And, you know, from the time of the Industrial Revolution, the mechanization of food production has been something that has been a great concern and has often sacrificed the will of, you know, the people for corporate profits. And so I think it's incredibly important for there to be a window into the kinds of corners that corporations are trying to cut when it comes to food production.
And hopefully in the near future, at least in Iowa, we will see that window opened. Matthew Lieben, thank you for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break. We come back more from the State of the Union, busting some of Donald Trump's false statements and also women's clothing getting criticized. Shocking in American politics, I know. We'll be back after this. Okay, more on the State of the Union with Jer Jackson. Let's turn now to a couple of his statements. We may have issues with Donald Trump. We may not like the tax bill, family separation, all of that. But apparently, thank God he got into office. Because did you know, if he hadn't, we would all be exploding in clouds of ash and nuclear waste. That's me saying that. Let's turn now to the president making the same point.
We continue our historic push for peace on the Korean Peninsula. Our hostages have come home. Nuclear testing has stopped, and there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months. If I had not been elected president of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
So you heard booing there. He could have just said the first half of that. It's definitely stretching the truth. He's massively exaggerating the progress there, all of that. But fine, that's what he does. But to then claim that we would have died in a nuclear holocaust if he hadn't been elected, I guess that's the Trump effect.
I'm not sure if he thinks that was going to land well and where he veered off of script. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if Stephen Miller wrote that part, but also we also see the basis for why he wanted to disagree with his intelligence community and everything they had when they presented the information about what was going on in North Korea and Iran. And basically he also went to the Iran deal and how he ripped that up to shreds. He needed to have this moment that somehow he felt was a winner. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, I'm gonna go out there and say that because of me, all of you guys would have been dead. Oh, if it wasn't for me, all of you guys would be broke. Remember those hyperbolic statements?
Or if I get impeached, the economy will fall apart or whatever, yeah. I don't know. My fear, I guess, is that North Korea is not a topic that gets talked about in the news a lot. People don't know much about it currently or historically. So my fear is that some people will watch that and will think, oh God, were we on the brink of war before Donald Trump was elected? That's not the case.
There's no evidence
to buttress what he said.
I don't want to meet that person, but I do want to meet that person just to find out whatever else they believe.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, look, we've been exposed thanks to the magic of social media to a lot of insanity over the past few years. Did you know that there's a significant number of people that think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is dead right now and that they are hiding her body somewhere so that Trump can't get her spot on the Supreme Court? This is the sort of argument that should have been hurt by the news a couple of days ago that she appeared in public, but they found a way past it and they're not buying that. That was a body double, perhaps a cardboard cutout. But anyway, if you can believe that, then you can believe that, yeah, the missiles were in the air. We were gonna get nuked and thank God Donald Trump was sworn in. Don't think it's actually the truth, but that's what the president's saying. Now, Donald Trump is very happy with the state of the economy. He is worried though that there are some things that could possibly hurt it. It might not be what you expect. Here he is talking about what needs to stop to keep our economic growth going.
I believe the time has come to bring that investigation and the other investigations of this matter to an end. 1 year of Watergate is enough.
No, sorry, we searched State of the Union investigations. And I guess that's what Alexa came up. Sorry, it's just really similar to what he said. Here's what Trump said.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. What are you talking? Like, okay, fine. If we're gonna have a strong economy, we can't have war. Well, certainly if we're gonna have peace, we can't have war. That sort of goes without saying. Fine, but you can't just add on whatever you want after that.
It's good. He's utilizing Kanye's help in the White House to write a good line so he can have something that rhymes. Mm-hmm. With some litigation, for some good litigation or legislation,
you can't have litigation.
Then we can't have all this investigation.
Yeah.
Oh, nailed it. Again, when you write that down, there's times when you write, and you go, oh yeah, that sounds good. And then you say it all and you go, no, that sucks. This should happen multiple times throughout the speech. Was that supposed to be like a, yes, mm-hmm. got him? This is really weird. Are you supposed to convince anybody with this line? So before, if I'm like, yeah, there's smoke all around this administration with their corruption. He just said, oh, in order to have legislation, we need no investigation. Okay, I changed my mind, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. That was a good line. I guess I don't care about any of this anymore.
Well, so you asked a question, does this convince anyone? So look, when this is up on YouTube, if you actually believe that investigating corruption in the White House will damage economic growth, feel free, leave a comment saying that. On the other hand, he puts that message out there, and I understand there's been a lot of willful suspension of disbelief over the past couple of years. There are people who, they can see that Michael Flynn lied about his contacts with foreign powers, that Manafort was hiding all this stuff, Roger Stone is lying about it. All of these people are lying just randomly. They're not lying to conceal anything, they're just all lying at the threat of possibly going to jail for years. Fine, okay, if you can believe that, that's fine. If he brings up in the State of the Union that the economy will tank if we keep investigating him, is that the thing that a person would do who is innocent of any wrongdoing? and is confident that the Mueller report will absolve him of any criminal behavior? Or is that what a person would say is if they think that they desperately need to kill the investigation before it is concluded? I'm not saying one way or the other. I want everyone who heard that speech to consider which of those explanations makes more sense.
That's all. Just think about what makes sense. And again, the next how from you being investigated then changes this economy? Because I thought this economy was in a boom, as he said very few times in the beginning. Yeah. It's a boom, like another boom, biggest boom. What are you talking about? So how? Why is it a boom? And then after it's a boom, why is it you being investigated is going to change that boom? Mm-hmm. Where do the two thoughts link?
Yeah.
Where does the logical thought continue? And it doesn't.
It does not. It does not. Okay, let's turn to another topic. There were some pretty good moments in the State of the Union. So we did have, you saw all the female members of Congress on the Democratic side wearing white to honor the suffragettes. And it made a very striking visual image when you see how many there actually are out there. It was pretty awesome. And Trump sort of by accident created a nice moment in that regard when this happened.
All Americans can be proud that we have more women in the workforce than ever before. Don't sit yet, you're gonna like this. And exactly one century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before. That's great. Very great. And congratulations. That's great.
That's great. I love seeing women in positions of power. Anyway, no, I thought it was a great moment. I know a lot of people's response was, Trump doesn't get that they got in office running against him. No, I think he knows that they're Democrats. I think it was a nice moment. It was a little bit weird, and obviously his record in everything having to do with women is horrendous. But that was a fine moment, and I liked that it became this sort of big part of the State of the Union was the women celebrating.
The surprising part was when the USA chant came out, he's like, wait a second, that's for us. Mm-hmm. It's totally the mindset. It's like, that's supposed to be for us to talk about hatred and ousting other people. That's what USA chants are for.
Yeah.
Not for inclusion.
Yeah, you cheer USA when you export oil or bomb Yemen, not when you have social change. And by the way, he mentioned there that it's 100 years after, you know, he gave that historical allusion. We also know that 30 years before the midterm elections of 2018, from 30 years ago to the midterm elections we just had, Republican women in Congress, the exact same number. They have not gained one. That is not random chance. There's reasons for that. And if they were to look into it, perhaps they could actually change and you could have some white on the opposite side of the aisle there. We'll see if they learn that lesson. Now, great moment. Not everybody was pleased with the women in the audience. Peggy Noonan, the Wall Street Journal wrote, they were good natured with the white jackets, who I see some on Twitter calling the straight jackets. AOC had a rare bad night, looking not spirited, warm, and original as usual, but sullen, teenaged, and at a loss. Thank you, Peggy Noonan, most influential woman in politics today. So if AOC is sitting, listening to Donald Trump speak, tell massive lies about the economy, immigration, foreign policy, all of that, she should be smiling. And look, I get that it's Peggy Noonan, and I get that she worded it differently, but how is that not a version of she needs to smile more?
Absolutely is.
That's also, all it is.
And also, she's too young to hold this office, right?
Teenage.
Yeah, so I knew what it meant, but I was like, let's see the official definition. Between 13 and 19 years old is the definition of teenage. I don't think she's between 13 and 19 years old. So in order to look teenage, you have to look young. And therefore, if you look young, it means that you're in the wrong place. You're not supposed to be here, Missy.
Yeah, yeah. And so AOC responded to this. She said, why should I be spirited and warm for this embarrassment of a State of the Union? Tonight was an unsettling night for our country. The president failed to offer any plan, any vision at all for our future. We're flying without a pilot, and I'm not here to comfort anyone about that fact. So it's a very good response, more dignified than the initial.
Because you know what it is, in general, with when it comes to establishment. In Washington, D.C. in general, it's no matter what's going on, no matter what policies have happened, no matter how much hatred this guy has been throwing around for 2 years, It doesn't matter. Once you get to these types of settings, you're supposed to be cordial, nice, smile, and act like you get along. No, because then as soon as he walks out of the room, or actually while he's still in the room, he throws some more hatred around. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to connect on here. I'm not being warm while he's being cold. Where's my warmth going for here?
Yeah.
What's the point of that? So you can smile and be happy about it? No, that's not what's going on here. The State of the Union is that it's very divided because of hatred in the White House.
Yeah, she was warm in the one moment where he wasn't viciously attacking them. She was warm then, okay, which seems reasonable. But by the way, one of the reasons I want to bring this up is if they're going to critique the women's clothes, and there's all these right-wing memes about the fact that they're wearing white like the KKK, that's a nice ahistorical take for you. But let's bring up this one last tweet. Where you can see there, AOC and also the congresswoman, I think it's Nydia Velasquez sitting next to her, are wearing pins with a picture of Jacqueline Kahl, the Guatemalan child who died in custody of Border Patrol there. So look, if you're gonna zoom in and focus so much on the clothing that these women are wearing, actually learn something from it. Because we heard a lot of names having to do with the border and the supposed national emergency there. But the children who died weren't brought up. I thought that was interesting that the president didn't spare a couple of moments for that. But there are politicians who are responsible and are willing to keep that story going and honor the memory of the tragic death of people like Jacqueline. AOC is one of them. Anyway, we do have to take one more break. We come back a little bit more. We're going to take a look at the response to the State of the Union after this. So there are a lot of different ways that you can evaluate a speech. You can take a look at the facts that are stated. We've been doing that, and they have come up wanting in a few different ways. But there's also, there is a message you're trying to get across, a story, a set of emotions. And to help break down that aspect of the State of the Union and the response of the State of the Union from Stacey Abrams, we're joined now by Roger Wolfson.
Hey, good to see you, John.
Great to have you here. So you're a Democratic consultant, you are a writer, you help to advise candidates on how to communicate. And so you were watching last night, Donald Trump. What story was he trying to get across?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if he himself had real clarity about his story. Mm-hmm. I think this was a build up the patriotism, fire up the base kind of speech, but there was no actual narrative. You know, there were moments that you could see him focusing on World War II vets and him focusing on the Holocaust and him mm-hmm. focusing on Buzz Aldrin. Mm-hmm. He was trying to call back sort of some of America's greatest hits. Mm-hmm. Because on some level, you know that if the president is talking about great patriotism, that it's going to affiliate somewhat to the president. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, you know, it was one of the only State of the Unions I've ever seen where there was no policy in it. Mm-hmm. He didn't talk about what he was going to do.
I guess the fighting HIV was one of the few.
Maybe. There was little tiny touches. But in terms of like a narrative, what you really saw him do effectively was frame issues. Mm-hmm. So if you hadn't elected me, we'd be at war, mm-hmm. right? There's a good solid, that's good solid framing. If you don't, if you investigate me, the economy is going to collapse. Mm-hmm. So he's really good at picking, you know, part of the law in both politics and in storytelling, because, you know, I write for TV shows and movies, is picking your villain. Mm-hmm. So what he did really well was he sort of framed who the bad guy was going to be and put himself in the situation of hero. Mm-hmm. So he did that relatively well, and it's going to work for his base. It's not going to work for any of the people who are rolling their eyes during the speech, yeah. but it's going to work for his base.
So I'm curious. I feel like if I was a president and my party controlled Congress, I might use the State of the Union to say, here is what I'm going to try to accomplish.
Right.
Do you think that him not advancing a policy agenda is in a sort of tacit acknowledgement that he is not going to accomplish much, and instead he wants to set the bounds for how the opposition can function in regards to him?
I think what he was trying to do was he was trying to just bring up his approval ratings a couple of points, mm-hmm. to speak to his base, and he was trying to frame it so that the public would be afraid of Democrats investigating him well, or afraid mm-hmm. of switching horses midstream, so to speak, because the economy is going so well. Mm-hmm. And I think he did that relatively well. Now, in terms of optics, he blew it across the board in a lot of ways. One of the simplest ways is when he was walking in, I don't know if you watched this, but when mm-hmm. he was walking in, there wasn't a single person of color or female that shook his hand. Mm-hmm. And that's easily addressable. You just plant somebody. Mm-hmm. By the same token, Stacey Abrams, and I don't know, I was watching relatively closely. I don't know if there was a white person standing behind or a white male standing. Could be wrong, but it certainly didn't feel that way.
Yeah.
And both of them could have addressed the optics a little bit to be more inclusive. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, in terms of Stacey Abrams' response, was it looked like she was just talking in a studio. Mm-hmm. He had just spoken in this grand circumstance. She didn't, you know, she could have done it in a building, in a public space, and something that actually looked a little bit more grandiose. And furthermore, she did one of the only State of the Union response I've ever seen where there wasn't an American flag visible. Now, I may be, again, mistaken. It may have been one in the wide shot, but in the close shot, there was no waving of the flags. And so, and also, she didn't do any policy. There was no, like, hey, these are what the Democrats are going to do, with the possible exception of talking about voting rights, which, again, is important. But voting rights, on some small level, are self-serving to Democrats, because we're the ones right now who are being taken advantage of because of the lack of them.
Yeah.
So when we talk about voting rights,
perhaps
it's important.
Perhaps in her example
right.
as well.
Exactly. And it is important. I'm not saying don't talk about it. And I actually wrote a portion, I helped write a portion of H.R. 1, which is the Democrats' first bill in Congress, which deals with voting rights. But I still don't feel that should have been H.R. 1.
Okay.
I think an infrastructure bill, something that actually deals with policy and that makes a difference for the average American, that would be better storytelling. That tells the story of what we want to accomplish.
So you sort of got into this already with a bit on her response, which I thought it was on a green screen, actually. Like, I guess it was not, but it looked like that was not an actual crowd
it
behind her.
Flat.
I suppose that it was.
They blurred them out. There was soft focus on them.
It was very soft focus, but it didn't look like natural soft focus. As a person who's like a fan of videography and all that. So in terms of its effectiveness as a response, is there any aspect in which you believe it succeeded?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, I think that she was personable and she was likable. Mm-hmm. Second of all, she told a person, she used I statements, which I really encourage politicians to do. Talk about yourself. Mm-hmm. She told a story that I think was emotional and had a message to it. The next step I would have said was pick a story too that connects to your competence, not just your passion. Mm-hmm. That's what I do when I work with politicians and speeches. But she did connect, I think. I think she connected. I think she came off as personable, and I think she told a story that was meaningful. Mm-hmm. Where I think it fell short a little bit was there wasn't any real policy. It sounded like a speech. It sounded like it was prepared. It sounded also like she could have given it at any point that day. She could have given it before the president's speech. She didn't, I mean, at the very least, there should have been a section in there that allowed her to comment on what we had all just seen.
Yeah, we noted that in her coverage.
Without that, it felt like, well, are we in the same room? Are we having the same experience? It felt disconnected. Mm-hmm. And if you look at like Stephen Colbert, he, I think, only had an hour in between the end of the State of the Union and his incredible routine about it. Mm-hmm. But he had people lined up to come up with material.
Yeah.
She could have done that too, or whoever organized it, you know, and helped her could have done that too. And that was that was short-sighted.
Yeah, and in Bernie Sanders' response, he did make reference to specific things that have been said. What we believe that they had access to the speech at least for a little bit of time before the actual performance of it. So I would have had people do that as well. So it's interesting. So you pointed out that she was likable, approachable. She spoke, I think, with passion. Maybe this is a petty point, but it felt like Donald Trump was half asleep during much of his speech. Like, he loves to call people low energy, but he did seem pretty low energy too. Do you think that that might have hurt the success of the State of the Union?
In all seriousness, I think he was gelded on this one. I think that, you know, I know I'm not allowed to swear or anything, but, you know, I think that his staff finally said, you have to stick to the teleprompter. And that's the Trump you get when he sticks to the teleprompter.
Yeah.
He doesn't have passion if he's reading words. He has passion when he's off the cuff. Mm-hmm. And he was stuck with that. So we were watching sort of a gelded version of Trump, not necessarily an ineffective version of Trump, but it wasn't him in his full level of machismo or stuff. What he did do, and I'll also talk about body language, both he and Stacey had good body language. Mm-hmm. He always sticks his chest out. He always, you know, stands upright. Mm-hmm. I don't really like his hand gestures like that. That doesn't really work for me. But with Stacey Abrams, she also had, you know, she also stood proudly and confidently. And that is, by the way, you know, very small percentage of what people receive in terms of information from us comes from our words.
Yeah.
A lot of it comes from our body language. And they both, I think, were conscious of that.
Yeah. Well, I wish that we had more time. There's a lot I'd like to talk about, especially about Donald Trump's body language. But that's all the time we have. Roger,
and his hands, right? Yeah.
And his hands.
Yes.
Oh, the movements. Roger, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime. We're going to take one more short break. When we come back, Fox News responds to their own polling on new policies to tax the rich. They're not big fans of it, shockingly. We'll have more on that after this. So over the past couple of months, we've seen a lot of renewed interest in the possibility of finally raising taxes on the rich, with AOC talking about higher marginal tax rates. You have Bernie Sanders' increased estate tax bill. You have Elizabeth Warren with her wealth tax bill. And Fox News obviously is not a fan of that sort of thing, but at a certain point, they can no longer hide from the truth when their own polls reveal what's going on. Let's see how they respond in real time.
What seems to be a movement against capitalism in this country. This is a piece in Politico just published, Soak the Rich. Americans say go for it. In this piece, it talks about how recent polling is showing that the American public is increasingly on board with raising taxes on the rich. As evidence, we pulled up this latest Fox News poll on the issue, whether Americans support raising taxes on the wealthy, on incomes over $10 million. Those that are in favor of that, 70%, Charles, over $1 million in income, 65% are in favor of raising taxes.
The idea of fairness has been promoted in our schools for a long time. And we're starting to see kids who grew up in this notion that fairness above all. And now they're becoming voting age and they're bringing this ideology with them.
They reveal so much. They reveal so much about themselves. Okay, first of all,
what do you got?
They don't know their idea of capitalism. Oh, can you believe people are against capitalism? Do you know what capitalism is? Mm-hmm. It's destroying everyone else beneath you while you hoard everything you can, and only winners is doing that. So as we promote capitalism and then give it this rosy picture of like everybody gets a chance, it's not the case. That's not mm-hmm. what capitalism is. And also, once you're faced with this with this reality, it's the schools. Again, it goes back to who's always been in power and who's been able to indoctrinate people. So they think the only reason people believe what they believe is not because it's any logic behind it, it's because they've been indoctrinated, because that's the way they do things. Mm-hmm. Like, we've been indoctrinating children and Americans our whole lives to think backwards and not in their own interest mm-hmm. and not know how the country is actually supposed to work. They're beginning to realize it, so they must be teaching them some BS around here. No, they're teaching them the reality, and now that must be indoctrination in those schools that we used to control and do some mind melds on people for. How does that work?
I just love his responses, these kids and their fairness. Goddamn Barney. You can't.
These kids in school wanting to not have to be swamped in school loans for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Oh, how dare they? Mm-hmm. That's not opportunity. This country's supposed to be for opportunity, not for just the same people get the same stuff and take it from everyone else hoping for that.
Yeah. What part of capitalism says that the top marginal tax rate should always be going down? Where does it say that in the tenets of capitalism, that they should always be lower than they were? That's not a part of it. You can still have total capitalist system and the rich pay a little bit more than they did last year. That is a reasonable tweak, okay? Wait until you find out what the next generation is actually going to want, because it's not going to be limited to slightly higher taxes on those making more than $10 million. There's going to be, thank God, a much needed rethinking of some of the fundamental tenets of our economic system that we have simply taken for granted for over half a century. Wait until they see that poll, okay? Look, we talked last week, I think it was. Like, a quarter of young Republicans are like, socialism? Not so bad. Wait until that is the dominant generation in the Republican Party, and then there's ones coming up behind them.
The scare tactics aren't working the same as they used to, and now they're shaking. They're like, we used to be able to scare everyone mm-hmm. into our beliefs, and man, they're not scared anymore.
Yeah.
We need to limit this information, this flow of information, because that's their problem.
Yeah, thank God they're not working. Okay, and by the way, caravan. Okay, maybe that'll scare them. One of the people who helped to start this conversation responded to that video. AOC said, just wait until they find out about the golden rule. Yeah, my God, do you guys read your Bible? Jesus liked fairness, man. I think that was one of his things. Anyway, okay, so I did want to read one of the reviews that have been left recently on iTunes for the Damage Report podcast, which you should, of course, subscribe to, listen to, and all of that. Lotus137 says, thanks for your show. Today was my first time watching, and I was very impressed with the stories, your personal perspective, the delivery of real news, and the very lively conversations you spark in your guests. You have a new viewer in me. Thank you, Lotus. If you would like to leave a rating and a review, there's a very good chance it'll be read on a future episode of the show, so I encourage you to do that. Also, facebook.com/thedamagereporttyt, go sign up there. Jer, thank you so much for joining us.
Get him to 10,000, this guy just had a birthday.
We got there, but get us to 20.
Look at that.
Okay, thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.